and welcome to Sight into Sound Radio's Christmas special, the 2018 edition of Mistletoe Mysteries, a cosy collection of criminality at Christmas time. There is no escaping the Christmas holiday season. It surrounds us with advertising tinsel, fills us with fancy cooking, smothers us in sentimental thoughts. World leaders talk about peace, while comic strip characters wrestle with Christmas trees. In the Western world, Christmas is a time for giving gifts. Deck the malls with throngs of shoppers. Hark the herald hucksters sing. Let us toys to the children bring. Mystery author P.G. Wodehouse recommends the giving of something shiny. He says, the shinier a gift is, the more it is thought to have cost, and thus the better the giver looks in the eyes of the receiver. Wodehouse suggests books are excellent gifts, as their covers are always shiny. Maybe you will be lucky enough to receive a brand new mystery novel or an anthology of mystery short stories this year. Maybe some thoughtful person will wrap for you a shiny Christmas mystery, a murder in tinsel, crime with sleigh bells. Christmas mystery stories, with their twists and hidden clues, are as much fun to unwrap as Christmas gifts. Why do writers choose to set murder and crime stories in this happy holiday season? Well, first, there is the cast of stock characters, well known to all. Santa, the ghosts of other Christmases, the three wise men, the shepherds, and the main players in the nativity scene. These characters need no introduction. They come equipped with a backstory. They can be tinkered with, shaped into the unexpected, given an evil underbelly. Well, maybe not the Holy Family, but all the rest are fair game. Especially Santa. Now here's a character begging to be given centre stage in a murder story. He's disguised, face and figure. He carries a sack, perfect for concealing stolen goods. He's expected to show up in strange places late at night. He is never turned away. Second, Christmas gatherings of friends and kin are often riddled with tensions. When a mid-sized group of people collects under one roof because they must, ill feelings can step over to the dark side quicker than you can say coshed with a roasted chestnut. Some authors play only lip service to Christmas, mentioning it in passing while they get on with the story. Others sew Christmas into the story so tightly the story could not possibly take place if it weren't Christmas. In the 2018 edition of Mistletoe Mysteries, you'll hear two short stories of merry mischief. Here Comes Santa Claus and The Haunted Crescent. I'm Pearl Hewitt. Our first story is by Bill Pronzini. Bill Pronzini is an American writer of detective fiction. He is also an active anthologist, having compiled more than 100 collections, most of which focus on mystery, Western, and science fiction short stories. He published his first novel, The Stalker, in 1971. However, his best-known works are the Nameless Detective series, which he also began in 1971. As of 2017, there are 46 books in the series, including a number of short stories. In our first Mistletoe Mystery, Bill Pronzini tells the story of a man who reluctantly plays Santa at a children's charity event, and his grumpiness and Scrooge-like behaviour puts him in the perfect mood to catch a crook. Here's Chuck Wolf reading Here Comes Santa Claus.
Carrie sprang her little surprise on me the week before Christmas. And the worst thing about it was, I was no longer fat. The 40-pound bowl full of jelly that had once hung over my belt was long gone. "That doesn't matter," she said. "You can wear a pillow." "Why me?" I said. "They made me entertainment chairperson for one thing, and for another, you're the biggest and jolliest man I know." "Ho, ho, ho," I said sourly. "It's for a good cause. Lots of good causes, needy children, the homeless, three other charities. Where's your Christmas spirit? I don't have any. Why don't you ask Eberhard? Are you serious, Eberhard? Well, somebody else then. Anybody else. You, she said. No. I love you madly, and I'll do just about anything for you, but not this. This is where I draw the line. Oh, come on. Quit acting like a Scrooge. I am a Scrooge. Bah, humbug. You like kids. You know you do. I don't like kids. Where'd you get that idea? I've seen you with kids. That's where. An act. Just an act. So put it on again for the benefit. 5 o'clock until 9. 4 hours out of your life to help the less fortunate. Is that too much to ask? Well, in this case, yes. She looked at me. Didn't say anything, just looked at me. No, I said. There's no way I'm going to wear a Santa Claus suit and dangle little kitties on my knee. You hear me? Absolutely no way. 1 week later. Ho, 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 I said. The little girl perched on my knee looked up at me out of big round eyes. It was the same sort of big round-eyed stare Carrie had given me the previous week.
Are you really Santa Claus? She asked.
Yes, indeedy. And who would you be?
Melissa.
Oh, that's a pretty name. How old are you, Melissa?
6 and a half.
6 and a half. Well, well. Tell old Santa what it is you want for Christmas.
A dolly.
Oh, what sort of dolly?
A big one.
Just a big one? No special kind?
Yes, a dolly that you can put water in her mouth and she wee-wees on herself.
I sighed. Ho, 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 I said. The Gala Family Christmas Charity Benefit was being held in the Lowell High School Gymnasium out near Golden Gate Park. Half a dozen San Francisco businesses were sponsoring it, including Bates & Carpenter, the ad agency where Carrie works as a senior copywriter, so it was a pretty elaborate affair. The decoration committee had dressed the gym up to look like a cross between Santa's Village and Dickens' Christmas Fair. There was a huge gaudy tree, lots of red and green bunting and seasonal decorations, big clusters of holly and mistletoe, even fake snow. And the staff members were costumed as elves and other creatures, imaginary and real. Carols and traditional favorites poured out of loudspeakers, booths positioned along the walls dispensed food, meat pies, plum pudding, gingerbread, and other sweets, and a variety of handmade toys and crafts, all donated. For the adults, there were a couple of city-sanctioned games of chance and a bar supplying wassail and other Christmassy drinks. And for the kiddies, there was me. I sat on a throne-like chair on a raised dais at one end, encased in false whiskers and a wig and a paunch, red suit and cap, black boots and belt. All around me were cotton snowdrifts, a toy bag overflowing with gaily wrapped packages, a shiny papier-mâché version of Santa's sleigh with some cardboard reindeer. A couple of young women dressed as elves were there too to act as my helpers. Their smiles were as phony as my whiskers and paunch. They were only slightly less miserable than I was. for snaking out to one side and halfway across the packed enclosure was a line of little children the Pied Piper of Hamelin would have envied, some with their parents, most without, and all eager to clamber up on old St. Nick's lap and share with him their innermost desires. Inside the Santa suit, I was sweating, and not just because it was warm in there. I imagined that every adult eye was on me, that snickers were lurking in every adult throat. Now, this was ridiculous, of course, the more so because none of the 200 or so adults in attendance knew Santa's true identity. I had made Carrie swear an oath that she wouldn't tell anybody, especially not my partner, Eberhardt, who would never let me hear the end of it if he knew. No more than half a dozen of those present even knew me anyway, this being a somewhat ritzy crowd, and of those who did know me, three were members of the private security staff. Still, I felt exposed and vulnerable and acutely uncomfortable. I felt the way you would if you suddenly found yourself naked on a crowded city street. And I kept thinking, what if one of those newspaper photographers recognizes me and decides to take my picture? What if Eberhardt finds out? Or Barney Rivera? Or Joe DeFalco? Or one of my other so-called friends? Another kid was on his way toward my lap. I smiled automatically and sneaked a look at my watch. My God, it seemed as though I'd been here for at least 2 hours. But only 45 minutes had passed since the opening ceremonies. More than 3 hours left to go. Close to 200 minutes. Nearly 12,000 seconds. The new kid climbed up onto my knee. While he was doing that, one of those near the front of the line, overcome at the prospect of his own imminent audience with the nabob of the North Pole, began to make a series of all too familiar sounds. Another kid said, "Oh, gross! He's gonna throw up!" Fortunately, however, the sick one's mother was with him. She managed to get him out of there in time. To the strains of "Walking in a Winter Wonderland." I thought, what if he'd been sitting on my lap instead of standing in line when he threw up? I thought, Carrie, I'll get you for this, Carrie. I listened to the new kid's demands and thought about all the other little helpful, piping voices I would have to listen to, and I sweated and smiled, and I tried not to squirm. If I squirmed, people would start to snicker. The kids as well as the adults, they'd think Santa had to go potty and was trying not to wee-wee on himself. This one kid had cider-colored hair. He said,
"You're not Santa Claus."
"Sure I am. Don't I look like Santa?"
"No, your face isn't red. And you don't have a nose like a cherry."
What's your name, Sonny?"
"Ronnie. And you're not fat either."
"Oh, sure I'm fat. Ho, ho, ho."
"No, you're not."
"What do you want for Christmas, Ronnie?"
"I won't tell you. You're a fake, and I don't need you to give me toys. I can buy my own toys."
"Good for you, kid."
"I don't believe in Santa Claus anyway," he said.
He was about 9, and in addition to being belligerent, he had mean little eyes. He was probably going to grow up to be an axe murderer. Either that or a politician. "If you don't want to talk to Santa," I said, feigning patience, "then how about getting off Santa's lap and letting one of the other boys and girls come up?"
No.
And without warning, he suddenly punched me in the stomach, hard.
Ha! He said. A pillow! I knew your gut was just a pillow!
Get off Santa's lap, Ronnie.
No!
I leaned down close to him so he could hear when I said, Get off Santa's lap, or Santa will take off his pillow and stuff it down your rotten little throat. We locked gazes for about 5 seconds. Then, taking his time, Ronnie got down off my lap. He stuck his tongue out at me and said,
Eh-ho,
and went scampering away into the crowd. I put on yet another false smile behind my false beard and said grimly to one of the elves, Next. While I was listening to an 8-year-old with braces and a homicidal gleam in his eye tell me that he wanted
a tank that has this neat missile in it, and you can shoot the missile and it blows up everything when it lands.
Carrie appeared with a cup in her hand. She motioned for me to join her at the far end of the dais behind Santa's sleigh. I got rid of the budding warmonger, told the nearest elf I was taking a short break, stood up creakily, and with as much dignity as I could muster, I made my way through the cotton snowdrifts to where Carrie stood. She looked far better in her costume than I did in mine. In fact, she looked so innocent and fetching, I forgot for the moment that I was angry with her. She was dressed as an angel, all in white, with a coat hanger halo wrapped in tinfoil. If real angels looked like her, I couldn't wait to get to heaven. She handed me a cup. It was full of some sort of punch with a funny-looking skinny brown thing floating on top.
I thought you could use a little Christmas cheer, she said.
Oh, I can use a lot of Christmas cheer. Is this stuff spiked?
Of course not. Since when do you drink hard liquor?
Since I sat down on that throne over there.
Oh, now, it can't be that bad.
No? Let's see. A 5-year-old screams so loud in my left ear I'm still partially deaf. A fat kid stepped on my foot and nearly broke a toe. Another kid accidentally kneed me in the crotch and nearly broke something else. Not 3 minutes ago, a mugger in training named Ronnie punched me in the stomach and called me anyway, those are just the highlights.
Oh, poor baby.
That didn't sound very sincere.
The fact is, she said, most of the kids love you. I overheard a couple of them telling their parents, what a nice old Santa you are.
Yeah. I tried some of the punch. It wasn't too bad, considering the suspicious brown thing floating in it. Must be a deformed clove, I decided. The only other alternative, something that had come back out of the back end of a mouse, was unthinkable. How much of this does the old Santa have to endure? I said.
2.5 hours.
Oh, God, I'll never make it.
Don't be such a curmudgeon, she said. It's 2 days before Christmas. We're taking in lots of money for the needy, and everybody's having a grand time, except you.
Well, you and Mrs. Simmons. Who's Mrs. Simmons?
Randolph Simmons' wife, you know, the corporate attorney. She lost her wallet somehow, all of her credit cards, and $200 in cash.
Oh, that's too bad. Tell her I'll replace the $200 if she'll agree to trade places with me right now. Carrie gave me her "sometimes you're exasperating" look.
"Just hang in there, Santa," she said, and started away.
"Don't use that phrase around the kid named Ronnie," I called after her. "It's liable to give him ideas." I'd been back on the throne less than 10 seconds when who should reappear but the little thug himself. Ronnie wasn't alone this time. He had a bushy, mustached, gray-suited, scowling man with him. The two of them clumped up onto the dais, shouldered past an elf with a cherubic little girl in hand, and they confronted me. The mustache guy said in a low, angry voice, "What the hell's the idea of threatening my kid?" "Fine, dandy. That's what I need is an irate father." "Answer me, pal. What's the idea of telling Ronnie you'd shove a pillow down his throat?"
"Well, he punched me in the stomach," I said.
"So? That'll give you the right to threaten him. Hell, I ought to punch you in the stomach."
"Do it, Dad," Ronnie said. "Punch the old fake."
Nearby, the cherub started to cry loudly. We all looked at her. Ronnie's dad said, "What did you do? Threaten her, too?"
"I want to see Santa. It's my turn. It's my turn."
The elf said,
"Don't worry, honey. You'll get your turn."
And Ronnie's dad said, "Apologize to the kid, and we'll let it go." Ronnie said,
"No, sock him one, Dad."
I said, "Do you mind telling me your name?" It was Ronnie's dad I spoke to. He looked blank for 2 or 3 seconds, after which he said, "Huh? Your name, what is it?" "What do you want to know for?"
You look familiar, very familiar, in fact. I think maybe we've met before."
He stiffened, and then he took a good, long, wary look at me, as if trying to see past my whiskers. And then he blinked, and all of a sudden, his righteous indignation vanished and was replaced by a nervousness that bordered on the furtive. He wet his lips. He backed off a step.
"Come on, Dad! Punch his lights out," the little thug said.
His dad told him to shut up. To me, he said, let's just forget the whole thing, okay?" And then he turned in a hurry and dragged the protesting Ronnie down off the dais and back into the crowd. I stared after them, and there was a little click in my mind, and I was seeing a photograph of Ronnie's dad as a younger man, without the big bushy mustache, and with a name and number across his chest. Ronnie's dad and I knew each other all right. I had once had a hand in having him arrested and sent to San Quentin on a grand larceny rap. Ronnie's dad was Marky Waters, a professional pickpocket and jack of all thievery, who in his entire life had never gone anywhere or done anything to benefit anyone except Marky Waters. So what was he doing at the Gala Family Christmas Charity Benefit? She lost her wallet somehow, all her credit cards and $200 in cash. Right. Practicing his trade, of course. I should have stayed on the dais. I should have sent one of the elves to notify security, while I perched on the throne and continued to act as a listening post for the kiddies. But I didn't. Like a damn fool, I decided to handle the matter myself. Like a damn fool, I went charging off into the throng with the cherub's cries of, "I want to see Santa! It's my turn to see Santa!" rising to a crescendo behind me. The milling crush of celebrants had closed around Marky Waters and his son, and I could no longer see them. But they had been heading at an angle toward the far assisted entrance, so that was the direction I took. The rubber boots I wore were a size too small, and they pinched my feet, forcing me to walk in a kind of a mincing step. And if that wasn't bad enough, the boots were new and made squeaking sounds like a pair of rusty hinges. I also had to do some jostling to get through and get around little knots of people, and some of the looks my maneuvers elicited were not of the peace on earth, goodwill to men variety. One elegantly dressed guy said, "Watch the hands, Claus," which might have been funny if I were not in such a dark and stormy frame of mind. I was almost to the line of food booths across the east wall when I spotted Waters again, stopped near the second to the last booth. One of his hands was clutching Ronnie's wrist, and the other seized plucking at an obese woman in a red and green, diagonally striped dress that made her look like a gigantic candy cane. Marky had evidently collided with her in his haste and caused her to spill a cup of punch on herself. She was loudly berating him for being a clumsy oaf and refusing to let go of a big handful of his jacket until she'd had her say. I minced and squeaked through another cluster of adults, all of whom were singing in accompaniment to the song now playing over the loudspeakers, the song of all darn things was "Here Comes Santa Claus." Waters may not have heard the song, but its message got through to him just the same. He saw me bearing down on him from 30 feet away, and he understood immediately what my intentions were. His expression turned panicky. He tried to tear loose from the obese woman's grip. She hung on with all the tenacity of a bulldog. I was 10 feet from getting my own bulldog hands on him when he proceeded to transform the Gala Family Christmas Charity Benefit from fun and frolic into chaos. He let go of Ronnie's wrist and shouted, "Run, kid!" And then with his free hand, he sucker-punched the obese woman on the uppermost of her chins. She not only released his jacket, she backpedaled into a lurching swoon that upset three other merrymakers and sent all four of them to the floor in a wild tangle of arms and legs. Voices rose in sudden alarm. Somebody screamed like a fire siren going off. Bodies scattered out of harm's way. And Marky Waters went racing toward freedom. I gave chase, dodging and juking and squeaking. I wouldn't have caught him except that while he's looking back over his shoulder to see how close I was, he tripped over something, his own feet maybe, and down he went in a sprawl. I reached him just as he scrambled up again. I laid both hands on him and growled, "This is as far as you go, Waters." Whereupon he kicked me in the shin and yanked free. I yelled, he staggered off, I limped after him. Shouts and shrieks echoed through the gym. So did the thunder of running feet and thudding bodies as more of the party animals stampeded. A woman came rushing out from inside the farthest of the food booths, got in Marky's path, and caused him to veer sideways to keep from plowing into her. And that, in turn, allowed me to catch up to him in front of the booth. I clapped a hand on his shoulder this time, spun him around, and he smacked me in the chops with something warm and soggy that had been sitting on the booth's serving counter. A meat pie. He hit me in the face with a meat pie. That was the last indignity in a night of indignities. Playing Santa Claus was bad enough. Playing Lou Costello to a thief's Bud Abbott was intolerable. I roared, I pawed at my eyes and scraped off beef gravy and false whiskers and white wig. I lunged and caught Waters again before he could escape. I wrapped my arms around him. It was my intention to twist him around and get him into a crippling hammerlock. But he was stronger than he looked. So instead, we performed a kind of crazy, lurching bear hug dance for a few seconds. And that came to an end, predictably, when we banged into one of the booth supports and the whole front framework collapsed in a welter of wood and bunting and pie and paper plates and plastic utensils, with us in the middle of it all. Marky squirmed out from underneath me, feebly, and tried to crawl away through the wreckage. I disentangled myself from some of the bunting, lunged at his legs, hung on when he tried to kick loose, and then I crawled on top of him, flipped him over on his back, fended off a couple of ineffectual blows, and I did some effectual things to his head until he stopped struggling and decided to become unconscious. I sat astraddle him, panting and puffing and wiping gravy out of my eyes and out of my nose. The tumult, I realized then, had subsided somewhat behind me. I could hear the loudspeakers again. The song playing now was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and I could hear voices lifted tentatively nearby, just before a newspaper photographer came hurrying up and snapped a picture of me and my catch, just before a horrified Carrie and a couple of tardy security guards arrived. I heard two voices in particular speaking in odd tones. "My God," said one of them, "what happened?" "I don't know," the other one said, "but it sure looks like Santa Claus went berserk." There were three of us in the football coach's office at the rear of the gym, Marky Waters and me and one of the security guards. It was 15 minutes later, and we were waiting for the arrival of San Francisco's finest. Waters was dejected and resigned. The guard was pretending not to be amused, and I was in a foul humor, thanks to a combination of acute embarrassment, some bruises and contusions, and the fact that I had no choice but to keep on wearing the gravy-stained remnants of the Santa Claus suit. It was what I'd come here in. My own clothes were back in Carrie's apartment. On the desk between Waters and me was a diamond and sapphire brooch, a fancy platinum cigarette case, and a gold money clip containing three crisp $50 bills. We had found all three items nestled companionably inside Marky's jacket pocket. I prodded the brooch with a finger, which prompted the guard to say, "Nice haul. The brooch alone must be worth a couple of grand." I didn't say anything, and neither did Marky. The owner of the gold clip and the three fifties had reported them missing to security just before Waters and I staged our minor riot. The owners of the brooch and cigarette case hadn't made themselves known yet, which was something of a tribute to Marky's light-fingered talents, talents that would soon land him back in the slammer on another grand larceny rap. He had his chin resting on his chest. Now he raised it and looked at me. "My kid," he said, as if he'd just remembered he had one. "He get away?" No, one of the other guards nabbed him out front.
Just as well. Where is he?
Being held close by. He's okay. Marky let out a heavy breath.
I shouldn't have brought him along.
So why did you?
It's Christmas. Paper said this shindig was for kids, too. Ronnie and me don't get out together much since his mother ran out on us 2 years ago.
Uh-huh, I said. And besides, you figured it would be easier to make your scores if you had a kid along as a camouflage, right? He shrugged.
You, though, I sure didn't figure on somebody like you being here. What in hell's a private dick doing dressed up in a Santa Claus suit?
I've been asking myself that question all night.
I mean, how can you figure a thing like that? Marky said. Ronnie comes running up. He says it's not really Santa up there. And the guy pretending to be Santa threatened him. Said he'd shove a pillow down my kid's throat. What am I supposed to do? I'd done a good night's work. I wanted to get out of here. Well, the getting was good. But I couldn't let some jerk get away with threatening my kid, could I? I mean, I'm a father, too, right?
He let out another heavy breath.
I wish I wasn't a father, he said.
What about the wallet, Marky?
Huh?
The wallet and the 200 in cash that was in it.
Huh?
This stuff here isn't all you swiped tonight. You also got a wallet belonging to a Mrs. Randolph Simmons. It wasn't on you, and neither was the 200. So what did you do with them?
I never scored a wallet, he said. Not tonight.
Marky,
I swear it. The other stuff, sure, you got me on that, but I'm telling you, I didn't score a wallet tonight.
I scowled at him, but his denial had the ring of truth. He had no reason to lie about the wallet. Well then, had Mrs. Simmons lost it, after all? If that was the case, then I'd gone chasing after Waters for no good reason, except that he was a convicted felon. I felt the embarrassment warming my face again. What if he hadn't dipped anyone tonight? I'd have looked like an even bigger fool than I did right now. Something tickled my memory and set me to pursuing a different and more productive line of thought. Oh, heck, of course. I'd been right in the first place. Mrs. Randolph Simmons' wallet had been stolen, not lost. And I knew now who had done the stealing. But the knowledge didn't make me feel any better. If anything, it made me feel worse. Empty your pockets, I said.
What for?
Because I told you to, that's what's for.
I don't have to do what you tell me.
No, if you don't, I'll empty them for you.
I want a lawyer, the boy said.
You're too young to need a lawyer, Ronnie. Now, empty your pockets before I smack you one. Ronnie glared at me. I glared back at him.
If you smack me,
he said,
it's police brutality.
9 years old, going on 40. I'm not the police, remember, Ronnie? This is your last chance, kid. Empty the pockets or else. But he emptied the pockets. He didn't have Mrs. Randolph Simmons' wallet, but he did have her $200, $204 to be exact. I don't need you to give me toys. I can buy my own toys. Sure. $204 can buy a lot of toys, not to mention a lot of grief. What did you do with the wallet, Ronnie?
What wallet?
Dumped it somewhere nearby, right?
I don't know what you're talking about.
No? Then where'd you get the money?
I found it.
Uh-huh. In Mrs. Randolph Simmons' purse.
Who's she?
Your old man put you up to it. Or was it your own idea? He favored me with a cocky little grin.
I'm smart, he said. I'm going to be just like my dad when I grow up.
Yeah, I said sadly. A chip off the old block, if ever there was one. Midnight. Carrie and I were sitting on the couch in her living room. I sat with my head tipped back, my eyes closed. I had a thundering headache and a brain clogged of gloom. It had been a long, long night, full of all sorts of humiliations. And the sight of a 9-year-old kid, even a thuggish 9-year-old kid, being carted off to the youth authority. At the same time, his father was being carted off to the Hall of Justice. And that was a pretty unfestive evening. I hadn't seen the last of the humiliations either. Tonight's fiasco would get plenty of tongue-in-cheek treatment in the morning papers, complete with photographs. Half a dozen reporters and photographers had arrived at the gym in tandem with the police. So there was no way Eberhardt and my other friends could help but find out. I was in for weeks of sly and merciless ribbing. Carrie must have intuited my headache because she moved over close beside me, and she began to massage my temples. She's good at massage. Some of the pain began to ease almost immediately. None of the gloom, though. You can't massage away gloom. After a while, she said, "I guess you blame me." "Why should I blame you?"
"Well, if I hadn't talked you into playing Santa..."
"You didn't talk me into anything. I did it because I wanted to help you and the benefit. No, I blame myself for what happened. I should have handled Marky Waters better. If I had, the benefit wouldn't have come to such a bad end, and you'd have made a lot more money for the charities."
"We made quite a bit, as it is," Carrie said. "And you caught a professional thief. And you save 4 good citizens from losing valuable personal property."
"And I put a kid in the youth authority for Christmas."
"You're not responsible for that. His father is."
"Sure, I know, but it doesn't make me feel any better." She was silent for a time, at the end of which she leaned down and kissed me warmly. I opened my eyes. "What was that for?"
"For being who and what you are. You grump and grumble and act the curmudgeon, but that's just a facade. Underneath, you're a nice man, a caring man with a big heart."
"Yeah, me and Saint Nick."
"Exactly."
She looked at her watch.
"It is now officially the 24th, Christmas Eve. How would you like one of your presents a little early?"
"Huh? Depends on which one."
"Oh, I think you'll like it."
She stood up.
"I'll go get ready for you. Give me 5 minutes.
I gave her 3 minutes, which, miraculously enough, was all the time it took for my pall of gloom to lift.
and then I got to my feet and went down the hall. "Ready or not," I said as I opened the bedroom door, "here comes Santa Claus."
You're listening to Sight into Sound Radio's Christmas special, the 2018 edition of Mistletoe Mysteries, a cozy collection of criminality at Christmas time. I'm Pearl Hewitt. Few mystery writers feel more comfortable and secure in the past than Peter Lovesey. This often charming, always fascinating British author thoroughly enjoys researching and creating the sense of an earlier time. Not always the same time, for his stories have spanned many decades. Peter lives near Bath and often walks past the Royal Crescent, entertaining himself by imagining things that might have gone on and perhaps might still be going on there. This mistletoe mystery is titled The Haunted Crescent. A ghost was seen last Christmas in a certain house in the Royal Crescent. Believe me, this is true. I speak from personal experience as a resident of the city of Bath and something of an authority on psychic phenomena. I readily admit that 90% of so-called hauntings turn out to have been hallucinations of one sort or another. But this is the exception, a genuine haunted house. Out of consideration for the present owners, who for obvious reasons wish to preserve their privacy, I shall not disclose the exact address. But if you doubt me, read what happened to me on Christmas Eve 1988. The couple who owned the house had gone to Norfolk for the festive season, leaving on the Friday, December 23rd. Good planning. The ghost was reputed to walk on Christmas Eve. Knowing of my interest, they had generously placed their house at my disposal. I'm an ex-policeman, by the way, and it takes a lot to frighten me. For those who like a ghost story with all the trimmings, deep snow and howling winds outside, I'm sorry. I must disappoint you. Christmas 1988 was not a white one in Bath. It was unseasonably warm. There wasn't even any fog. All I can offer in the way of atmospheric effects are a full moon that night and an owl that hooted periodically in the trees at the far side of the sloping lawns that fronts the crescent. It has to be admitted that this was not a spooky-looking barn owl, but a tawny owl, which on this night was making more of a high-pitched kee-wick call than a hoot. Quite cheery, in fact. Do not despair, however. The things that happened in the house that night more than compensated for the absence of werewolves and banshees outside. It is vital to the story that you are sufficiently informed about the building in which the events occurred. Whether you realise it or not, you have probably seen the Royal Crescent. If not as a resident or a tourist, then in one of the numerous films in which it has appeared as a backdrop to the action. It is in a quiet location northwest of the city and comprises 30 houses in a semi-elliptical terrace completed in 1774 to the specification of John Wood the Younger. It stands comparison with any domestic building in Europe. I defy anyone not to respond to its uncomplicated grandeur, the majestic panorama of 114 iconic columns topped by a portico and balustrade, and the roadway at the front where Jane Austen and Charles Dickens trod the cobbles. But you want me to come to the ghost. My first intimation of something unaccountable came at about 11:20 that Christmas Eve. I was in the drawing room on the first floor. I had stationed myself there a couple of hours before. The door was ajar and the house was in darkness. No, that isn't quite accurate. I should have said simply that none of the lights were switched on. Actually, the moonlight gave a certain amount of illumination, silver-blue rectangles projected across the carpet and over the base of the Christmas tree, producing an effect infinitely prettier than fairy lights. The furniture was easily visible too, armchairs, table, and grand piano. One's eyes adjust. It didn't strike me as eerie to be alone in that unlit house. Anyone knows that a spirit of the departed is unlikely to manifest itself in electric light. No house is totally silent. Certainly no centrally heated house. The sounds produced by expanding floorboards in so-called haunted houses up and down the land must have fooled ghost hunters by the hundred. In this case, as a precaution against a sudden freeze, the owners had left the system switched on. It was time to turn off at 11, so the knocks and creaks I was hearing now ought to have been the last of the night. As events turned out, it wasn't a sound that alerted me first. It was a sudden draft against my face and a flutter of white across the room. I tensed. The house had gone silent. I crossed the room to investigate. The disturbance had been caused by a Christmas card falling off the mantelpiece into the grate. Nothing more alarming than that. Cards are always falling down. That's why some people prefer to suspend them on strings. I stooped, picked up the card, and replaced it, smiling at my overactive imagination. Yet I had definitely noticed a draft. The house was supposed to be free of drafts. All the doors and windows were closed and meticulously sealed against the elements. Strange. I listened, holding my breath. The drawing room where I was standing was well placed for picking up any unexplained sound in the house. It was at the centre of the building. Below me were the ground floor and the cellar. Above me, the second floor and the attic. Hearing nothing, I decided to venture out to the landing and listen there. I was mystified, yet unwilling at this stage to countenance a supernatural explanation. I was inclined to wonder whether the cut-off of the central heating had resulted in some trick of convection that gave the impression, or the reality, of a disturbance in the air. The falling card was not significant in itself. The draft required an explanation. My state of mind, you see, was calm and analytical. 10 or 15 seconds passed. I leaned over the banisters and looked down the stairwell to make sure that the front door was firmly shut, and so it proved to be. Then I heard a rustle from the room where I had been. I knew what it was, the card falling into the grate again, for another distinct movement of air had stirred the curtain on the landing window, causing a shift in the moonlight across the stairs. I was in no doubt any more that this was worth investigating. My only uncertainty was whether to start with the floors above me or below. I chose the latter, reasoning that if, as I suspected, someone had opened a window, it was likely to be at the ground or basement levels. My assumption was wrong. I shall not draw out the suspense. I merely wish to record that I checked the cellar, kitchen, scullery, dining room, and study, and found every window and external door secure and bolted from inside. No one could have entered after me. So I began to work my way upstairs again, methodically visiting each room. And on the staircase to the second floor, I heard a sigh. Occasionally in Victorian novels, a character would heave a sigh. Somehow the phrase had always irritated me. In real life, I never heard a sigh so weighty that it seemed to involve muscular effort. Until this moment. This was a sound hauled up from the depths of somebody's inner being, or so I deduced. Whether it really originated with somebody or something was open to speculation. The sound had definitely come from above me. Unable by now to suppress my excitement, I moved up to the second floor landing, where I found three doors, all closed. I moved from one to the other, opening them rapidly and glancing briefly inside. 2 bedrooms and a bathroom.
I hesitated. A bathroom. Had the sigh, I wondered, been caused by some aberration of the plumbing? Airlocks are endemic in the complicated systems installed in these old Georgian buildings. The houses were not built with valves and cisterns. The efficiency of the pipework depended on the variable skill of generations of plumbers. The sound must have been caused by trapped air. Rationality reasserted itself. I would finish my inspection and prove to my total satisfaction that what I had heard was neither human nor spectral in its origin. I closed the bathroom door behind me and crossed the landing to the last flight of stairs, more narrow than those I had used so far. In times past, they had been the means of access to the servants' quarters in the attic. I glanced up at the white-painted door at the head of these stairs and observed that it was slightly ajar. My foot was on the first stair and my hand on the rail when I stiffened. That door moved. It was being drawn inward. The movement was slow and deliberate. As the gap increased, a faint glow of moonlight was cast from the interior onto the panelling to my right. I stared up and watched the figure of a woman appear in the doorway. She was in a white gown or robe that reached to her feet. Her hair hung loose to the level of her chest. Fine, gently shifting hair, so pale in colour that it appeared to merge with the dress. Her skin, too, appeared bloodless. The eyes were flint black, however. They widened as they took me in. Her right hand crept to her throat, and I heard her give a gasp. The sensations I experienced in that moment of confrontation are difficult to convey. I was convinced that nothing of flesh and blood had entered that house in the hours I had been there. All the entrances were bolted. I had checked. I could not account for the phenomenon, or whatever it was, that had manifested itself. Yet I refused to be convinced. I was unwilling to accept what my eyes were seeing and my rational faculties could not explain. She could not be a ghost. I said, "Who are you?" The figure swayed back as if startled. For a moment I thought she was going to close the attic door, but she remained staring at me, her hand still pressed to her throat. It was the face and form of a young woman, not more than 20. I asked, "Can you speak?" She appeared to nod. I said, "What are you doing here?" She caught her breath. In a strange, half-whispered utterance, she said, as if echoing my words, "Who are you?" I took a step upward toward her. It evidently frightened her, for she backed away and became almost invisible in the shadowy interior of the attic room. I tried to dredge up some reassuring words. "It's all right. Believe me, it's all right." Then I twitched in surprise. Downstairs, the doorbell chimed. After 11 on Christmas Eve. I said, "What on earth?" The woman in white whimpered something I couldn't hear. I tried to make light of it. "Santa, I expect." She didn't react. The bell rang a second time. "He ought to be using the chimney," I said. I had already decided to ignore the visitor, whoever it was. One unexpected caller was all I could cope with. The young woman spoke up, and the words sprang clearly from her. "For God's sake, send him away." "You know who it is?" "Please, I beg you." "If you know who it is," I said reasonably, "wouldn't you like to answer it?"
"I can't."
The chimes rang out again. I said, "Is it someone you know?"
"Please, tell him to go away. If you answer the door, he'll go away."
I was letting myself be persuaded. I needed her cooperation. I wanted to know about her. "All right," I relented. "But will you be here when I come back?"
"I won't leave."
Instinctively, I trusted her. I turned and descended the two flights of stairs to the hall. The bell rang again. Even though the house was in darkness, the caller had no intention of giving up. I drew back the bolts, opened the front door a fraction, and looked out. A man was on the doorstep, leaning on the iron railing. A young man in a leather jacket, glittering with studs and chains. His head was shaven. He, at any rate, looked like flesh and blood. He said, "What kept you?" I said, "What do you want?" He glared. "For crying out loud, who the hell are you?" His eyes slid sideways, checking the number on the wall. I said with frigid courtesy, "I think you must have made a mistake." "No," he said. "This is the house, all right. What's your game, mate? What are you doing here with the lights off?" I told him that I was an observer of psychic phenomena. "Come again?" "Ghosts," I said. "This house has the reputation of being haunted. The owners have kindly allowed me to keep watch tonight." "Oh, yes," he said with heavy scepticism. "Spooks, is it? I'll have a gander at them myself." With that, he gave the door a shove. There was no security chain, and I was unable to resist the pressure. He stepped across the threshold. "Ghostbuster, are you, mate? You wouldn't by any chance be lifting the family silver at the same time? Anyone else in here?" I said, "I take exception to that. You've no right to force your way in here." "No more right than you," he said, stepping past me. "Were you upstairs when I rang?" I said, "I'm going to call the police." He flapped his hand dismissively. "Be my guest. I'm going upstairs, right?" Sheer panic inspired me to say, "If you do, you'll be on film." "What?" "The cameras are ready to roll," I lied. "The place is riddled with mics and tripwires." He said, "I don't believe you." But the tone of his voice said the opposite. "This ghost is supposed to walk on Christmas Eve," I told him. "I want to capture it on film." I gave a special resonance to the word capture. He said, "You're round the twist." And with as much dignity as he could muster, he sidled back toward the door, which still stood open. Apparently he was leaving. "You ought to be locked up. You're a nutcase." As he stepped out of the door, I said, "Shall I tell the owners you called? What name shall I give?" He swore and turned away. I closed the door and slid the bolts back into place. I was shaking. It had been an ugly, potentially dangerous incident. I'm not so capable of tackling an intruder as I once was, and I was thankful that my powers of invention had served me so well. I started up the stairs again, and as I reached the top of the first flight, the young woman in white was waiting for me. She must have come down two floors to overhear what was being said. This area of the house was better illuminated than the attic stairs, so I got a better look at her. She appeared less ethereal now. Her dress was silk or satin, I observed. It was an evening gown. Her makeup was as pale as a mime artist's, except for the black liner around her eyes. She said, "How can I thank you enough?" I answered flatly, "What I want from you, young lady, is an explanation." She crossed her arms, rubbing at her sleeves. "I feel shivery here. Do you mind if we go in there?" As we moved into the drawing room, I noticed that she made no attempt to switch on the light. She pointed to some cigarettes on the table. "Do you mind?" I found some matches by the fireplace and gave her a light. "Who was that at the door?" She inhaled hard. "Some guy I met at a party. I was supposed to be with someone else, but we got separated. You know how it is. Next thing I knew, this bloke in the leather jacket was chatting me up. He was all right at first. I didn't know he was going to come on so strong. I mean, I didn't encourage him. I was trying to cool it. He offered me these tablets, but I refused. He said they would make me relax. But then I was really scared. I moved off fast. The stupid thing was that I moved upstairs. There were plenty of people about, and it seemed the easiest way to go. The bloke followed. He kept on following. I went right to the top of the house and shut myself in a room. I pushed a cupboard against the door. He was beating his fist on the door, saying what he was going to do to me. I was scared out of my skull. All I could think of doing was getting through the window, so I did. I climbed out and found myself up there behind the little stone wall. Of this building? The balustrade at the top? Didn't I make that clear? The party was in a house a couple of doors away from you. I ran along this narrow passageway between the roof and the wall, trying all the windows. The one upstairs was the first one I could shift. The attic window. Now I understand. The sudden draft was explained, and the gasp as she had caught her breath after the effort. She said, "I'm really grateful."
"Grateful?"
"Grateful to you for getting rid of him."
I said, "It would be sensible now to call a taxi. Where do you live?"
"Not far. I can walk."
"It wouldn't be advisable, would it, after what happened? He's persistent. He may be waiting."
I didn't think.
She stubbed the cigarette into an ashtray. After a moment's reflection, she said,
"All right. Where's the phone?"
There was one in the study. While she was occupied, I gave some thought to what she had said. I didn't believe a word of it, but I had something vastly more important on my mind. She came back into the room.
10 minutes, they reckon. Was it true what you said downstairs about this house being haunted?
I was still preoccupied.
The spook? All that stuff about hidden cameras? Did you mean it?
There aren't any hidden cameras. I'm useless with machinery of any sort. I reckoned he'd think twice about coming in if he knew he was going to be on film. It was just a bluff.
And the bit about the ghost?
Oh, that was true.
Would you mind telling me about it?
Aren't you afraid of the supernatural?
It's scary, yes. Not so scary as what happened already. I want to know the story. Christmas Eve is a great night for a ghost story.
I said, "It's more than just a story."
"Please?"
"On one condition. Before you get into that taxi, you tell me the truth about yourself. Why you really came into this house tonight."
She hesitated.
I said, "It needn't go any further."
"All right. Tell me about the ghost."
She reached for another cigarette and perched on the arm of a chair. I crossed to the window and looked away over the lawn toward the trees silhouetted against the city lights. It can be traced back, as all ghost stories can, to a story of death and an unquiet spirit. About 150 years ago, this house was owned by an army officer, a retired colonel by the name of Davenport. He had a daughter called Rosamond, and it was believed in the city that he doted on her. She was dressed fashionably and given a good education, which in those days was beyond the expectation of most young women. Rosamond was a lively, intelligent, and attractive girl. Her hair, when she wore it long, was very like yours, fine and extremely fair. Not surprisingly, she had admirers. The one she favoured most was a young man from Bristol, Luke Robertson, who at the time was an architect. In the conventions of the time, they formed an attachment which amounted to little more than a few chaperoned meetings, some letters, poems, and so on. They were lovers in a very old-fashioned sense that you may find difficult to credit. In physical terms, it amounted to no more than a few stolen kisses, if that. Somewhere in this house, there are supposed to be carved into woodwork the letters L and R, linked. I can't show you. I haven't found it.
Outside, a taxi trundled over the cobbles. I watched it draw up at a house some doors down. Two couples came out of the building laughing
and climbed into the cab. It was obvious that they were leaving a party. The heavy beat of music carried up to me. I said, "I wonder if it's turned midnight. It might be Christmas Day already." She said, "Please go on with the story." Colonel Davenport, the father of this girl, was a lonely man. His wife had died some years before. Lately, he had become friendly with a neighbour, another resident of the Crescent, a widow approaching 50 years of age by the name of Mrs. Crandley, who lived in one of the houses at the far end of the building. She was a musician, a pianist, and she gave lessons. One of her pupils was Rosamund. So far as one can tell, Mrs. Crandley was a good teacher and the girl was a promising pupil. "Do you play?" "What?" I turned to face her. I said, "Do you play the piano?" "Oh, just a bit," said the girl. "You didn't tell me your name."
"I'd rather not, if you don't mind. What happened between the Colonel and Mrs. Crandley?"
"Their friendship blossomed. He wanted her to marry him. Mrs. Crandley was not unwilling. In fact, she agreed, subject to one condition. She had a son of 27 called Justinian."
"What was that?"
"Justinian. There was a vogue for calling your children after emperors. This Justinian was a dull fellow, without much to recommend him. He was lazy and overweight. He rarely ventured out of the house. Mrs. Crandley despaired of him."
"She wanted him off her hands?"
"This is what it amounted to. She wanted him married, and she saw the perfect partner for him in Rosamund. Surely such a charming, talented girl would bring out some positive qualities in her lumpish son. Mrs. Crandley applied herself diligently to the plan, insisting that Justinian answered the doorbell each time Rosamund came for her music lesson. Then he would be told to sit in the room and listen to her playing. Everything Mrs. Crandley could do to promote the match was done. For his part, Justinian was content to go along with the plan. He was promised that if he married the girl, he would be given his mother's house, so the pattern of his life would alter little, except that a pretty wife would keep him company rather than a discontented, nagging mother. He began to eye Rosamund with increasing favour. So when the Colonel proposed marriage to Mrs. Crandley, she assented on the understanding that Justinian would be married to Rosamund at the same time."
"How about Rosamund? Was she given any choice?"
"You have to be aware that marriages were commonly arranged by the parents in those days."
"But you said she already had a lover. He was perfectly respectable, wasn't he?"
I nodded. "Absolutely. But Luke Robinson didn't feature in Mrs. Cranley's plan. He was ignored. Rosamund bowed under the pressure and became engaged to Justinian in the autumn of 1838. The double marriage was to take place in the Abbey on Christmas Eve."
"Oh dear. I think I can guess the rest of the story."
"It may not be quite as you expect. As the day of the wedding approached, Rosamund began to dread the prospect. She pleaded with her father to allow her to break off the engagement. He wouldn't hear of it. He loved Mrs. Crandley, and his thoughts were all of her. In despair, Rosamund sent the maidservant with a message to Luke, asking him to meet her secretly on the basement steps. She had a romantic notion that Luke would elope with her." My listener was enthralled.
"And did he come?"
"He came." Rosamund poured out her story. Luke listened with sympathy, but he was cautious. He didn't see elopement as the solution. Rather bravely, he volunteered to speak to the Colonel and appeal to him to allow Rosamund to marry the man of her choice. If that failed, he would remind the Colonel that Rosamund could not be forced to take the sacred vows. Her consent had to be freely given in church, and she was entitled to withhold it. So this uncomfortable interview took place a day or two later. The Colonel, naturally, was outraged. Luke was banished from the house and forbidden to speak to Rosamund again. The unfortunate girl was summoned by her father and accused of wickedly consorting with her former lover when she was promised to another. The story of the secret note and the meeting on the stairs was dragged from her. She was told that she wished to destroy her father's marriage. She was said to be selfish and disloyal. Worse, she might be taken to court by Justinian for breach of promise.
Oh, poor little soul. Did it break her?
No. Amazingly, she stood her ground. Luke's support had given her courage. She would not marry Justinian. It was the colonel who backed down. He went to see Mrs. Crandley. When he returned, it was to tell Rosamond that his marriage would not, after all, take place. Mrs. Crandley had insisted on a double wedding or nothing.
Whew, I wouldn't have been in Rosamond's shoes for £1,000,000.
She was told by her father that she had behaved no better than a servant, secretly meeting her lover on the basement steps and trifling with another man's affections, so in future he would treat her as a servant. And he did. He dismissed the housemaid. He ordered Rosamond to move her things to the maid's room in the attic, and he gave her a list of duties that kept her busy from 5:30 each morning until late at night.
Cruel.
All his bitterness was heaped on her.
Did she kill herself?
No, I said with only the slightest pause. She was murdered.
Murdered?
On Christmas Eve, the day that the weddings would have taken place. She was suffocated in her bed.
Horrible.
A pillow was held against her face until she ceased to breathe. She was found dead in bed by the cook on Christmas morning after she failed to report for duty. The colonel was informed and the police were sent for.
Who killed her?
The inspector on the case, a local man without much experience of violent crimes, was in no doubt that Colonel Davenport was the murderer. He had a powerful motive. The animus he felt toward the daughter had been demonstrated by the way he treated her. It seemed that his anger had only increased as the days passed. On the date he was due to have married, it became insupportable.
Was it true? Did he confess to killing her?
He refused to make any statement. But the evidence against him was overwhelming. 3 inches of snow fell on Christmas Eve. It stopped about 8:30 that evening. The time of death was estimated at about 11 p.m. When the inspector and his men arrived next morning, no footsteps were visible on the path leading to the front door, except those of the cook, who had gone for the police. The only other person in the house was Colonel Davenport. So he was charged with murdering his own daughter. The trial was short, for he refused to plead. He remained silent to the end. He was found guilty and hanged at Bristol in February 1839. She put out the cigarette.
Grim.
Yes.
There's more to the story, isn't there? The ghost. You said something about an unquiet spirit.
I said, there was a feeling of unease about the fact that the colonel wouldn't admit to the crime. After he was convicted and condemned, they tried to persuade him to confess, to lay his sins before his maker. A murderer often would confess in the last days remaining to him, even after protesting innocence all through the trial. They all did their utmost to persuade him, the prison governor, the warders, the priest, and the hangman himself. Those people had harrowing duties to perform. It would have helped them to know that the man going to the gallows was truly guilty of the crime. Not one word would that proud old man speak.
You sound almost sorry for him. There wasn't really any doubt, was there?
I said, there's a continuous history of supernatural happenings in this house for a century and a half. Think about it. Suppose, for example, someone else committed the murder.
But who else could have?
Justinian Crandley.
That's impossible. He didn't live here. His footprints would have shown up in the snow.
Not if he entered the house as you did tonight, along the roof and through the attic window. He could have murdered Rosamond and returned to his own house by the same route.
It's possible, I suppose. But why?
What was his motive? Revenge. He would have been master in his own house if the marriage had not been called off. Instead, he faced an indefinite future with his domineering and now embittered mother. He blamed Rosamund. He decided that if he was not to have her as his wife, no one else should.
Is that what you believe?
It is now, said I.
Why didn't the Colonel tell them he was innocent?
He blamed himself. He felt a deep sense of guilt for the way he had treated his own daughter. But for his selfishness, the murder would never have taken place.
Do you think he knew the truth?
He must have worked it out. He loved Mrs. Cranley too much to cause her further unhappiness. There was an interval of silence, broken finally by the sound of car tires on the cobbles below. She stood up.
Tonight, when you saw me at the attic door, you thought I was Rosamund's ghost.
No, Rosamund doesn't haunt this place. Her spirit is at rest. I didn't take you for a real ghost any more than I believed your story of escaping from the fellow in the leather jacket. She walked to the window.
It's my taxi.
I wasn't going to let her leave without admitting the truth. You went to the party two doors along with the idea of breaking into this house. You climbed out onto the roof and forced your way in upstairs, meaning to let your friend in by the front door. You were going to burgle this place. She gasped and swung around.
How did you know that?
When I opened the door, he was expecting you. He said, what kept you? He knew which house to call at. So it must have been planned. If your story had been true, he wouldn't have known where to come. She stared down at the waiting cab. I said, until I suggested the taxi, you were quite prepared to go out into the street where this man who had allegedly threatened you was waiting.
I'm leaving.
And I noticed that you didn't want the lights turned on. Her tone altered.
You're not the fuzz, are you? You wouldn't turn me in. Oh, give me a break, will you? It's the first time. I'll never try it again.
How can I know that?
I'll give you my name and address if you want. Then you can check.
It is sufficient to state here that she supplied the information. I shall keep it to myself. I'm no longer in the business of exposing petty criminals. I saw her to her taxi. She promised to stop seeing her boyfriend. Perhaps you think I let her off too lightly. Her misdemeanor was minor compared with the discovery I had made. And I owed that discovery to her. It released me from my obligation, you see. I told you I was once a policeman. An inspector, actually. I made a fatal mistake. I have had 150 years to search for the truth, and now that I've found it, I can rest. The haunting of the Royal Crescent is at an end.
Enjoyed Sight into Sound Radio's Christmas special, the 2018 edition of Mistletoe Mysteries, a cozy collection of criminality at Christmas time. These two stories were selected from the book titled Mistletoe Mysteries, Tales of Yuletide Murder, collected by Charlotte MacLeod and the online Mystery Network at mysterynet.com. Your producer was Jim Martinez. I'm Pearl Hewitt. On behalf of the staff and volunteers at Sight into Sound, we would like to wish you a very Merry Christmas.